Hi, welcome to the Set Python Girls Club podcast. I'm your host, Luciana.
And I'm your co-host, Kim Madeline. Let's get going. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of the Set Python Girls Club podcast. I'm here, Kim Madeline, with my co-host, Luciana. Hey, Luciana, how's it going?
Hello, I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Today, our guest is Graham Wheeler. I hope I pronounced your last name correctly.
Yep.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us today. How are you?
I am doing good.
All right, so could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I am, as you can tell from the funny accent, from South Africa, but I've been living in the United States for the last 20 years, working at Microsoft a lot of that time. And currently, I manage the Python runtime team in Microsoft Developer Division and have various products underneath that portfolio that I guess we'll talk about.
I'm definitely excited to talk about all this stuff that you do. My first question for you is, how did you even get into Python in the first place?
So, I'm old. I knew about Python from when it was very first announced, because back in those days, the internet was kind of pretty much Usenet news groups. And if you followed the programming language news groups, you heard about things like, you know, Python when they were first announced. You heard about things like Linux when they were first announced. Can't really do that as easily anymore. But I was very much a systems programmer and doing a lot of embedded systems work in those days, C++. So I had no real reason to use it. But probably about 10 years ago or so, I read a blog post by a person who was very fanatical about player pianos. You know, those pianos that have the roll of paper with the holes punched in them and they can play tunes. And apparently a lot of the music on those player pianos is not available anywhere except on the player pianos. And this person was quite fanatical about sort of collecting this music and learning to play it themselves. And what they discovered is that there were quite a few videos on YouTube of these player pianos operating. And so their blog post was really how they went from videos on YouTube of player pianos to transcribed sheet music using Python. And they did all of this in the space of maybe 100 to 200 lines of code. And it just totally blew me away. I was like, wow, if I had to do that, you know, writing in C++, it would probably take me years and I'd probably get several PhD degrees out of it or something along the way. So I realized at that point just, you know, how highly leveraged the language it was because of the ecosystem around it. And I was pretty much sold then. So I started using it then. I fell in love with it very quickly. And I pretty much only use it now, although I've used many other languages over the years. It's my only language now.
I love that. It's the power of Python, right? The simplicity. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's super powerful. And you get to do things with like just a few lines of code, which is wonderful. Yeah. Also, yeah. One of the reasons I love the language so much. So it's awesome that you get to work with Python nowadays at Microsoft. And how did you get into Microsoft in the first place?
So back in the 90s, I was doing a startup. I actually had a company where we built one of the first internet firewalls. And that was a whole lot of fun. I learned a whole lot, but we were dot-com victims around, you know, the year 2000 or so. And my wife was pregnant with our first child and she said, get a real job. And I had friends who were living in Seattle, friends who worked at Amazon. So I kind of applied to Amazon and I was about to take a job at Amazon. And at the last minute, I'd actually forgotten that I'd sent my resume into Microsoft at some point, I think into Microsoft Research. And just before I said yes to Amazon, I got a call from Microsoft saying, do you want to interview? And I said yes. And they flew me over and I interviewed and I ended up joining the Windows networking group as a security program manager in those days and spent about 2 or 3 years as a security PM working on mostly on cryptographic stuff. And after that, I bounced around. One of the great things about Microsoft is, you know, we do so many different things. So I had the opportunity after that of working on smartwatches and robotics and machine learning and all sorts of things in my first decade. Yeah. So it's been a fun journey.
That's awesome. And you started then as a PM. How did you transition into the software engineering role?
That's kind of funny. Because I had all this embedded programming experience in C and C++, one of the projects that I worked on was the smartwatch project, the spot watches they were called. Some people may remember those. And they used the FM radio network for data transmission. And we had these machines called subcarrier injectors up in the radio towers that would take the data that we wanted to send out and permute the FM signal in a way that the receivers could then reverse the process and extract the data out of them. And Microsoft had these built by a third-party company who, once the project was up and running, when we wanted some changes, they wanted to charge us a lot of money. But we happened to have the source code. So sort of people on the team were asking, does anyone know how to, you know, like program firmware, or, you know, in C? Because most of the people were .NET programmers at that point. And I was like, yeah, I do. I'll do it. And I started. So I made some modifications to that firmware. And I just realized again how much I loved writing code and decided to switch back to being a developer.
And when did you start incorporating Python into your professional life? Like go from those player pianos to
I was at Google for some time, and I worked on a project called Cloud Data Lab, which was basically a hosted Jupyter in the cloud. And there's a long story there, which I'm not really going to go into with company politics and stuff, but there were two separate initiatives at Google. One of them was Colab and one was Data Lab. And in a Colab is the one that I think has ultimately been successful. But that was the first time that I was writing a lot of Python code. We were basically, you know, implementing Jupyter in the cloud. I fell in love with Jupyter as well at that point, and the whole sort of notebook way of doing incremental development. It was something that was very interesting to me from the point of view of getting back into the world of, you know, big data and machine learning and things like that. So I did have an opportunity after that to go and lead a data science and machine learning team at eBay, and went and did that for a few years. And then while I was doing that, I saw it. I followed a lot of people in the Python world, and amongst them, I followed Brett Cannon, who's, you know, head of the Python Steering Council now. And one day I saw a tweet from Brett saying, "Who wants to be my boss?" And I thought, huh, interesting. I would love to go and do that. So I applied to the job which I currently have. And that's how I ended up back at Microsoft.
I love that. Who wants to be my boss? Me. Sign me up.
Yeah, who doesn't want to get to push Brett around, right?
It does sound like the dream. Well, we're very lucky to have you in the team nowadays. And so you kind of touched on it, and I would like to talk a little bit more about the projects that you drive. So The first one that I am very like biased towards, obviously, as the PM for Pylance. Mm-hmm. How is it like being the dev lead behind Pylance, seeing it come from being built from scratch to being the default language server for the Python extension and all of the typing work that we do that is related to that too, right?
Well, I'm definitely not the dev lead, of course. I'm just the pointy-headed boss in the picture here. But, you know, it's been a very exciting product. There's some history that may be a little bit interesting, in that we did have a language server, IntelliSense engine, in Visual Studio for many years in the Python experience there. And when we first started doing Python in Visual Studio Code, we adopted that. And that was written in .NET. So it was quite painful, really, because we had to, you know, download .NET Core. It was all C# code running in this thing that was otherwise all TypeScript. And we had problems getting the performance where we wanted it to be. And you know, some of that was less onerous in Visual Studio, but Visual Studio Code was the super fast, highly responsive editor, and people wanted things to operate really fast. And the approach that we had in the old language server was a little bit more like a traditional compiler of, you know, boiling the ocean and indexing all the files and trying to build up a complete sort of picture of things. And then once that was done, incrementally keeping it updated. And there was definitely problems with startup performance there, where it might take a few minutes before you got your first results, you know, when your order completes and things like that. And while we were doing that, Eric Trout, who is a technical fellow at Microsoft and certified genius, was put in charge of a fairly large Python team. And Eric is kind of interesting in that he's not a big fan of Python, even though actually over the last couple of years, he's contributed a lot to Python, I think. He's very much a believer in strictly typed languages and the way that they can help you find errors and so on. And he felt that the code base that his team was working on could really benefit from type annotations and a type checker. And he wanted one that was super fast. So he went and built PyWrite, which is the static type checker that we ship. And he came to us at some point and said, you know, maybe you should reconsider building your language server on top of this. And it is interesting. Anders Helsberg from the TypeScript team gave a talk at some point, which may be available publicly, about building modern compilers. And things have changed a lot from the old days of, you know, you would do lexical analysis and syntax analysis and semantic analysis and build your symbol table and your optimization and your code generation. Now, compilers are very much more embedded in the tools themselves and are used for things like autocomplete and so on. So you actually have to have a very different architecture that can work from the point where you need an answer backwards and just figure out the things that it needs to know at that point to give you the answer. And that's how the TypeScript language server and TypeScript compiler has been architected. And Eric worked a lot with them, for the ideas that he incorporated into PyWrite. So it was a tough decision for us because obviously there's a lot of sunk cost there. And, you know, we felt that we've made a lot of performance improvements and we were on a good track. But we went and did an evaluation of building stuff on top of PyWrite. And it looked like it was going to be a good thing. So we did this big pivot. And yeah, the rest is history.
I love that. And because it was built on top of PyWrite, it does use typing information, right? So I remember there was this challenge that we had that not all libraries, especially not all of the super popular libraries that people are using out there, especially for data science projects, have typing information. So what was kind of the strategy that the team took to try to overcome that challenge?
That is and remains a big challenge. It is very encouraging that we see a lot more adoption of type annotations and type stubs in by package authors. And I don't think the expectation is ever really that, you know, the whole world is going to adopt type annotations in Python and particularly in end user code. That's unlikely to happen. But if you are publishing a library on PyPI, and you want to have people have a great experience in code editors when they're using that library, type annotations can help a lot. We can fill in some of the gaps using type inference, and we have a pretty powerful type inference engine. But A, there's a performance cost to that, so you get less responsive results. And B, it's a very hard problem to solve, actually, in a language like Python. So there's many cases where it fails. And so what that means, like in Visual Studio Code, is that we typically dial down the type checking, you know, level of PyWrite a lot. So we get the order completions from the inference, but we don't necessarily show you a lot of errors, just because there can be a lot of false positives from those errors. So, you know, all we can do is try to encourage people to write types. What we have done in the meanwhile, though, is we have contributed some type stubs to TypeShed, and we did a lot of work on Pandas stubs, because Pandas, of course, is a hugely popular and important library, and one that's very near and dear to my heart. I was a bit biased on that. And the great news there is that after we did these stubs, we actually got the Pandas dev team to take over maintenance of those stubs. And we've just done stubs for Matplotlib as well. And I haven't yet reached out to the Matplotlib team, but if they're listening, I will be. And right now I'm actually working on a utility that I should have pretty wrapped up in the next few days, I think, which can do a lot of generation of type stubs for scientific Python packages, because they do have a convention for doc strings with quite a lot of typing information in there. So we can extract that. And after doing some, it's human readable stuff. It's not really formal annotations, but you know, I can get like 75% of that converted over into a useful Python type and shove it in as an annotation. So that's going to be very helpful as well.
I'd like to rewind a little bit on what you were saying earlier about type adoption, and also kind of ties into like the pandas theme, maintaining the stubs for pandas. So you're saying that in VS Code, PyLens tones down the type checking a lot because we don't show many errors and whatnot. So I guess for beginner users, all of these errors would show up as kind of noise and they wouldn't really know how to handle them. So I guess it's more of an open-ended question, but do you have like any ideas or suggestions on how to make, I guess, types more accessible and more widely adopted by the beginner user base, like students or like new developers?
Well, first of all, one thing that I would say is if you want to get the good editor experience, the most important annotations to have are return type annotations, right? There's not a lot that parameter type annotations are going to provide. They are going to help with finding errors and with type checking, and they will help a little bit with inference if we rely on inference. But if you think about what's going on in autocomplete, usually we want to know, you know, let's say we call a function, we want to know what type of object it returns so that when you press dot after that call, you can provide the right set of methods as autocompletions. So having return type annotations can completely short circuit all the cost of evaluating that. So I'd say from an editor experience point of view, focus on that. If you're trying to find errors in your code, otherwise, I would say the Python type system can get pretty hairy. You know, it's easy to do simple types. If you're doing just strings and integers and floats and so on, that's very, very simple stuff to do. Once you get into more complicated generics and, you know, for example, if you have a callback function where you want to be able to specify that the arguments that get passed to the thing that does the callback matches the signature of the callback, things like that can get pretty hairy, and I'd probably stay away from that as a learning developer in Python.
And one tip I would give for folks who are interested in learning more about TypePython is to try the inline hints feature that we have with PyLens now in VS Code. There are two settings that we enable that functionality for. I believe it's function return types as well as variable types. I will drop a link in the description of this episode with a video from Jay Miller, who is a developer advocate here at Microsoft, where he's talking a little bit more about type hints and the inline hints that we offer in VS Code. And just because I'm talking about Jay Miller, just a random comment here for those who are listening. Jay is the co-host of a new podcast for Python who's out there too. So just a shout out to Python Community News. Also drop a link in the description for folks who are interested. I believe it's new. I think they have 2 episodes out so far. But if you're interested in checking out another podcast just like ours, do check it out. But I wanted to talk about the other project that you're heavily involved in, which is the CPython performance team. Would you mind sharing a little bit more about that with us?
Yeah, sure. So that's an interesting initiative too. A lot of people know Guido came and worked at Microsoft some time back. And, you know, he was pretty much given a very open directive of, you know, go and find something interesting to work on. That helps the Python community. So he spent some time thinking about it, and this was the thing that he thought would be most useful. So we built up a team. We've got some great people on the team, several core Python developers and others. And we actually meet and with some people who are outside of Microsoft as well, who are also involved in improving Python performance. And there were some very good contributions to Python 3.10, where I think there's been some significant performance improvements, a lot of them coming out of this team. And now for 3.11, there's a lot of foundational work that's going on too, refactoring of the whole system to make it a lot cleaner. You have to be very careful when you're making optimizations and performance improvements, right, that you don't break the code in the process. Nobody wants to have, oh, it's faster, but now it does something different, right? So it's very important to be able to test the stuff, for example. So we've refactored the CPython code base in such a way that we can now write unit tests to validate that the optimizations are occurring as we expect them to occur and things like that. And there's a lot of other work going on in just cleaning up the code base overall and making it better structured to support the kind of things that we want to support. There's some discussion going on as well around JIT. I think ultimately that's what we're working towards. But there's a lot of steps along the way. And one of the steps, for example, is just trying to think about ways in which we can make the bytecode more low level, because the current bytecode is fairly tied to some high-level Python semantics. And by going to something that's a little bit more low level, we can already start doing a bunch of optimizations that aren't currently possible. So if you think, for example, of reference counts, right? Python memory is managed mostly through reference counting. And so any bytecode operation may involve a bunch of reference count operations as well. And it may be that some of those are unnecessary. For example, maybe you're increfing on something, and then later on you're doing a decref on the same thing, all within an instruction or bytecode instructions worth of code. That may be redundant. So if we made those explicit, for example, or at least got things to the granularity where things like reference counting was explicit, we could look for those kind of optimizations where we can just completely get rid of it. So yeah, I think it's a big project, obviously, that's going to be carrying on for a long time. I think by DevDev standards, it's a pretty well-staffed team. Doesn't mean it's necessarily a big team, as you know, DevDev, we tend to try to do a lot with a little. But yeah, very exciting team as well.
Okay, so two questions. These two questions are more geared towards your engineering manager hat rather than developer hat. So the first question is, so how do you justify foundational work? Like, how do you manage to convince the higher-ups that this foundational work is necessary and that you're about to spend like multiple cycles on that without showing any, you know, visible benefits from one day to another? And I guess the second question is more, how do you handle the PR of big evil corp Microsoft doing foundational work in Python?
So let me start with the second one first, right? Because I think on the one hand, I think the work that we're doing is valuable to a lot of people. And I think people see the value in it. So I don't think we have to sell them on that. But at the same time, Python is a volunteer-driven project. And if you do have a company like Microsoft who suddenly has like, you know, several of the core developers working full-time on making changes, and they're fairly significant changes. Performance changes are big changes. That can cause friction in various ways, right? It can cause friction in terms of people need to do code reviews and maybe they don't have the bandwidth, and you throw in PRs over the wall at a rapid pace. I mean, we could approve our own PRs, but that doesn't seem like a good idea either, right? So trying to manage that, it certainly has its challenges. And I think one of the things to bear in mind here is that we're not doing this necessarily because we want Python to be faster. We would like Python to be faster, but that's not why we did this project. We did this project because, you know, we hired Guido and we wanted to do something for the Python community. So I have stressed to the team, and I think the team has internalized this as well, that the important thing here is doing good in the community. So if that means we put aside some of the performance work at times, for example, to help out on 3.11 stability, we should do that. We need to be very responsive to the kind of feedback that we might get about, oh, we're moving too fast and potentially breaking things. So, you know, having this unit testing framework that we built is very useful for that kind of thing. So I think there are ways, if we were purely driven by, oh, we want to make Python, you know, five times faster in the next year, I think that would cause a lot of problems for us. But because the main goal here is actually just contributing to the community in a way that brings a lot of value, that gives us the flexibility to be a little bit more adaptive and accommodating and hopefully not ruffle too many feathers along the way. In terms of your first question, well, I didn't have to do the convincing. So, you know, that was obviously, Guido does not report to me. The rest of the CPython performance team reports to me. Guido reports to my boss, John Cunningham, who, you know, manages all of the language runtimes in DevDev. And I think part of the deal, you know, of hiring Guido was, you know, we're going to give you the resources you need to get something done that you want to get done. So I didn't have to do that pitch, thankfully.
If you had to make that pitch, what would that look like now?
If I had to make that pitch, I would probably be spending a lot more time you know, talking to teams within Microsoft who are using Python and trying to figure out, oh, can we show dollar value in terms of, you know, Azure savings and so on. And I've encouraged the team to, you know, think about doing that anyway, because it's always good to have that kind of thing to show for what you're doing anyway. It justifies your existence in other ways too. But that's not what's driving them. But yeah, if I didn't have Guido as the cell here and I had to go and make the pitch, I'd be trying to find ways in which, we're going to save so much money, you know, running our cloud because we've made Python so much faster.
Yeah, that makes sense, especially because Microsoft has so many different products and teams working on Python now, which mm-hmm. is always exciting. I think every week I learn about a new team that is using Python that I had absolutely no idea.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting point about Pylance too, which people don't necessarily realize. You know, they look through the lens of VS Code at Pylance and think, oh, you know, it's this VS Code extension. But Pylance is actually embedded in a lot of our products. We have Python in a bunch of our cloud products. We have notebook experiences in a bunch of cloud products. We have Azure Data Studio, you know, there's Cousteau Explorer, there's Synapse, we've got Minecraft with Python in it. And there's some really interesting stuff coming down the pipe that I can't really talk about yet, where we put in Python as well. And all of these places, you know, they need a great Python editing experience. And so Pylance is powering a lot of different experiences across the company. It's not just something that's in VS Code. And VS Code is just one of the places where it shows up.
That's a very good point. Something that I think a lot of folks in the community are not super aware of. Mm-hmm. So I do appreciate that you brought that up.
All right. So Pylance and performance improvement in CPython. Cool. Is there any other interesting project that any of your teams are working on?
We have several projects. We have Python in Visual Studio, the Python debugger. Windows builds of Python are done by Steve Dower on my team. So Python in the Windows Store and the Windows builds on python.org. And most recently, we are trying to bootstrap the Python ecosystem on Windows ARM64 devices. You may have seen an announcement at Build about, you know, we have new Windows ARM64 devices coming out soon that are hopefully going to be a lot better than older ones in terms of their power and battery life and things like that. And we would like those to be great developer machines as well. And in order to do that, we need the different languages to work well on them. We're not necessarily supporting our developer tools yet on those machines for Python, simply because we first need to get the Python ecosystem itself bootstrapped. So I have a couple of people, well, Steve Dower is contributing to that, but I have someone else as well, just gradually working through the process of, you know, URL lib and requests and cryptography and various other libraries and making sure we can build and run them and they pass the tests and gradually sort of checking off the list so we can get to the point where Py performance is one of the things we're trying to get going now and all of its dependencies. So that by the time these devices come out, you will certainly be able to use Python. There may be some things that still need work, but a lot of Python stuff should be in place and working at that point. And so, you know, if developers want to use those machines with Python, they can. If they want to get their packages running better on those machines, they can, and so on.
So what are the bigger challenges at the moment about porting Python to ARM64? Is it a bumpy road kind of work, or is it like a smooth sailing?
I would say it's not that big a problem. It was difficult at first because we didn't have a native C compiling, and you know everything had to be cross-compiled. There's also some issues with, you know, Rust is starting to become more popular now. So, of course, you know, you have to get Rust working. For some of the numeric stuff like NumPy, you ideally want Fortran working. It's not just the case of, oh, we can get Python working, right? There's all these other languages that are dependencies as well. Some of them are in better states than others. I think one of the big challenges we have right now is still, how do we do continuous integration? Because we don't have the machines available yet in GitHub to run GitHub Actions on those. And hopefully that's something that will get addressed at some point. But it does mean, you know, there's still a fair amount of manual building and testing, or at least not CICD type building and testing that has to go on to maintain things.
But it's exciting. All of your teams are building the future for Python going forward. And I am looking forward to see what is the result of all of the work that you have all been making towards making Python better across different ecosystems. So thank you for being behind all of that. On that note, I would like to ask you the question that we always ask to all of our guests. What is your favorite emo or sad song, since you are in the Sad Python Girls Club podcast, after all?
I like a lot of EDM, actually. So not really a lot of like sad stuff. But if I think about that, I have a song which I find very melancholy. I always kind of say, oh, that's the song I want to hear on my deathbed. So maybe that's a good choice. And that is, there's a Danish band called Bliss, and they have a song called Kissing. The album that it comes from was actually inspired by someone who had malaria, and they were stuck in a hospital and sort of in a, drifting in and out of consciousness for days. And the whole album is just, it's got this very sort of melancholy vibe through it, and it's absolutely beautiful music.
I love that. Yeah, I can totally see how that can be a sad song, given all the struggles behind it. Thank you for sharing that. And what's your favorite ice cream flavor to go with your favorite song?
Oh, that's easy. Song? Chocolate fudge brownie all the way.
Wow, I think I was the first person who like answered right away without having to think
about
it.
That's pretty fast.
Except no substitutes.
Any favorite brand or anything?
It's, you know, I try a lot of different brands, and Ben and Jerry's is still the best. Everybody else skimps on the brownie.
That's fair, and I can understand that and relate to that. Awesome. Thank you so much for being with us, Graham, and sharing all the amazing work that you and your team have been doing. And thank you again for co-hosting with me, Kim Adeline.
Thanks again for having me, Luciana. Thanks for joining, Graham.
Yeah, thanks to both of you. I enjoyed this.
That's it for today's episode for the Sad Python Girls Club podcast. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope to see you again soon.